Hi, this is Michael Ironside, and you're listening Without Your Head.
Welcome to the Station of Decapitation Without Your Head. I'm Nasty Neil.
I'm Treacherous Trista.
And we're joined by the returning Jeremy Pepsin. Yes, you can introduce yourself, Jeremy.
Hello, I'm Jeremy Pepsin, and I'm thrilled to be back on the show.
Yeah, it's very, I think it's, it was either 2006 or 2007 you were on, so it's been, a long time, 14 or 13 years.
About a lifetime, but you know, the movie I am now birthing into the world has taken a lifetime, so it's not shocking that it's been so long.
The Dead Ones. So how long have you been working on The Dead Ones?
We shot The Dead Ones in 2009.
Oh, wow.
And probably it'll be no secret or surprise by the time this airs that it's a school shooter ghost story of sorts. So when we shot it, it was not, I mean, obviously it was already, you know, an issue, and there were, horrible incidents that had already occurred and that the film was at least in part based on, but it took 11 years because by the time we wrapped principal photography with 70% of the movie done, we had understandably a difficult time finding investors to help us get the rest of the movie finished because, you know, we'd have somebody interested and Sandy Hook would happen or something else horrible and people would get cold feet. And I get it, but it was never my intention to self-finance post for 11 years, but that's exactly what I did.
Wow. What's that experience like to, you know, have your movie finished or almost finished for that long and then to finally get it out there?
Horrible. I mean, horrible until it's done. And now it's, I have a lot of very complicated answers to that question. It feels good. It's obviously the pandemic has as you said before you introed, you know, there are no film festivals to speak of. And a lot of the kind of excitement of meeting fans and seeing your film with the cast and an audience and getting to speak in front of Q&As and get out in front of the movie and talk about what your intentions were, that's gone. So it's a complicated time to be releasing a movie, but thus far, I've been very pleased with the reaction.
Like you said, it's a good feeling now that it's out, but it's also mixed because you can't have it out you the way you wanted. But I assume those 11 years are very...
not having the movie come out. Yeah, I'm grateful to have... I think Artsploitation is the right distributor. I think they've done a great job. Raven Banner did that deal. And, look, a lot of people make movies that never, ever see the light of day. And I'm very aware of that. And I'm grateful that the movie is finding a release and finding an audience. You make a movie that is controversial and with intention. And, it's really important to me to speak to you guys and fans and the audience in the world and talk about the film and make it clear that my intention is not ever to exploit the subject matter, but to speak to it, because I think appropriately people could find revulsion at the notion of making a film like this. And I think it's really important to address that out in front of the movie. And so that's really the part that's hardest for me, is the difficulty in that.
Mm-hmm. It might have been before I started recording, but you mentioned that you left LA, you're living in Maine now. Did the experience, these 11 years of trying to get the movie made, did that have any input on leaving LA? I don't know if you're still involved in movie making.
I love Los Angeles. I mean, I love Los Angeles with all my heart. I felt more at home in Los Angeles than anywhere else. I fell in not so much with the horror community, but with the magic community, actually, and was welcomed after Wizard of Gore, strangely, by the world of variety arts performers. And I was directing spook shows and variety shows with magicians and sword swallowers and contortionists, and felt like I had found my real group of lunatic fringe, I guess. Uh-huh. Like the Ed Wood thing of like, these are my people. And I really miss that. But the movie business, which I worked both sides of, I was, always made independent genre films, but I also worked in marketing for studio movies. It's changed. And as an editor, I was making more of my living supporting my family in TV, reality TV, which I have a distaste for, honestly. It wasn't my thing. And I think that probably fighting to see the movie through for so long, so hard, made me want to have a new chapter and a new experience. Mm-hmm.
Real quick too, about the magic community. Did you get to go to the Magic Castle in LA? Cause when I was out there, I didn't know how hard it was to get there, but I was invited. And so I got to go. And then afterwards there were a lot of people like, oh wow. Like, I guess it's really hard to get invited to the Magic Castle.
It's, it's a private club, for members only. I don't know, how difficult or not. One of the first times I went that really changed my life is I went with Crispin Glover to go see magicians for, to prep for The Wizard of Gore. And we worked with a magician who trained Crispin a little bit. And because of that, I met the daughter of the husband and wife and his brother who started the castle back in 63. And before that, they did shows for each other, for Orson Welles and Cary Grant and all these like fabulous Hollywood people would meet in this theater behind their home that was built as a demonstration stage for magic in the 20s called Brookledge. And it's called the most famous address in magic because it was, I know this is way off topic for horror movies, but just to give you a little bit of background, it was Floyd Thayer who built all the most impressive illusions in the 20s. He lived there, and so he built the stage to demo magic on. And after 63, the theater was shuttered when the castle became the replacement for magicians to gather, and it became the actual club. And in 2007, Erica Larson, whose father started the castle with her mom, asked me, she said she wanted to reopen the theater. And she asked me if I wanted to direct the shows and be part of bringing this theater back to life, which we did, and was where I was directing and doing stage and met so many incredible people. You know, I would look out in the audience and it would be Paul Rubens and Ryan Gosling and, you know, Marty Croft from H.R. Puffin stuff. Like, yeah, it was just 50 seats, but every person in every seat was like people who had changed my life. So it was an incredible experience. And in part, we're here in Maine to do something different but similar and do a Little Rascals style barn theater with variety arts for families. So it's a long ways off, but that's the dream.
Yeah. And by the way, if people haven't seen that, your Wizard of Gore, Crispin Glover is really amazing as Montag.
I agree. He is really good in it. Of all the things I could say, good or bad, about that movie, I think Crispin is definitely one of the things I still thrill at the fact that, you know, I got to work with him. He played Montag and is, you know, a true a movie star. I mean, he exudes charisma, and it's he believes everything he does, and that's really extraordinary.
I'm trying to remember the line because it's one of my favorite line. It's my favorite line in the movie, and it's his delivery. It's he says the things. It's like the things they tell you, and then he goes lies. And the way he says it was is my favorite. The delivery is amazing. Is what I'm trying to say.
It is. It is. It's something special.
Yeah. We're going to talk about the dead ones, but real Herschel Gordon Lewis. Did you have much interaction with him?
I went to first movie was called The Attic Expeditions, and it's actually the 20-year anniversary. It's being re-released through Severin, which I'm thrilled about, and getting a loving re-release. And I mean, I'm tickled. I never expected to see that movie reemerge as some kind of piece of, you know, classic horror canon. It's really cool. So when that movie also took me a really long time. We went into production with not enough money, ran aground, and for 4 years raised money and shot as we could. And in that time, I went to Fangoria Convention in New York City. And it was the first time that I was showing up, you know, not as a fan, but as a filmmaker. And we showed some scenes from the movie in process and a temp trailer. And Herschel was there. And I met him, and I got to talk to him. I got to hang out a little bit with him, and he was so kind and warm, and I told him it was my dream to remake his movies and give them a very polished new take treatment. And he said, I think that sounds great. You know, he had a booming voice, very big man. And it was like, that, I think that sounds great, and I would love to see what you make of that. And years later, when we... He didn't own the remake rights, so we worked hard to acquire those rights. It took a long time. And when the movie was done, I showed it to him, and he was so kind and so warm and encouraging. And at the time, not everybody's reaction to the movie went that way. And so it meant a lot that he was happy because, it, you know, I was doing a cover of his creation, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Herschel Gordon Lewis. His movies and, like you said, him as a person. He's one of my favorite interviews on the show. Honestly, the best commentary tracks are Herschel Gordon Lewis because of the voice. Even if you're not interested, because I'll be honest, I like his horror movies. I'm not interested in like some of his the biker chick movies. That's not really my cup. But if you just listen to it for the commentary track, they're amazing. And also, by the end of any of his commentary track, you'll think you just watched like Gone with the Wind of horror films or The Taxi Driver of horror films, because he'll really put it over as the best movie. And I love Herschel Gordon Lewis. They're not necessarily the greatest, but he'll really sell you on them. I highly recommend
them. He has a great take on filmmaking. And, you know, I think that in the kind of Roger Corman, William Castle, Lewis, those guys and creating Ballyhoo and having a sense for how to get audiences excited about movies that were made for very little money, but offered something different than studio fare. you know, those are my heroes. So I agree. He deserves to convince us that he made Gone with the Wind.
I agree.
In a sense, he did.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Honestly, I mean, it's original slasher, really, the Blood Feast.
He changed the face of what people thought of scary movies as being. Nobody had done what he did. Mm-hmm. No matter how people feel about those films, they're not wonderful films. They're not crafted films. But there's something about them that I think is really interesting. And one of the things I think is really cool about the Lewis movies is they're not shot like on a soundstage. They're not on a set. They're in some depressing house in Florida in the 60s. And so they're gaudy, but they're real. And it makes it feel very immediate in a way that I think a lot of other films don't have from that period.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't have it here, but I have a hand-painted top hat that my friend Annabelle painted with all my favorite monsters. And it has Fuad Ramsey's from the original Blood Feast. Wow. And he's one of the characters that most people don't even know who that is. They're like, who is that guy? But it's one of my favorite characters. So,
it was an early Halloween costume for me.
I think you could pull that off. Yeah. Tristan, did you have a question? Sorry to take all the questions.
Not at all. When I was watching your film, I for some reason I was struck by, like, I wonder if this guy likes immersive theater, because I really like immersive theater, and something about the film had that quality. Although, like, really, school shooting immersive theater experience would be a hard sell.
Agreed.
Something about the way the film was shot just reminded me of that. And then hearing about your background in magic, like, I think there's some crossover in that community, so that makes sense to me. Yeah. So I am wondering if you have any experience or interest in immersive theater.
Yes. Well, and I think all film is still, even if you're sitting home in front of a computer by yourself, it's still putting on a play, right? You're still doing a show for someone. And the immersive theater and theater in general has to be very conscious of their audience. And I think genre films, one of the things that works really well about genre films, even low budget movies, first films, when they work, it's that consciousness that good theater tends to have, and the actors in it, and sharing that theatrical experience. You know, I think I approach the filmmaking process. I did a lot of theater growing up, so I think it's hard to extricate myself, my love for film, from my love for theater.
Right when the Dead One started, and it's a scene with the bullying. It was interesting to me because I think that same scene in movies not that long ago would have been played for laughs. It would have been comedy, you know, putting a underwear over someone's head and dunking them in the toilet. And it's, you know, I think people are more aware now of what bullying is and, you know, how the effects it has on people. But it's interesting to me because I do think in a lot of movies that would have been played for comedy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the sort of screwball teenage comedies of the 70s and 80s had lots of that. Revenge of the Geeks. And I mean, it's a trope, but there's a reason it's a trope. And I think, you know, for writers and filmmakers who are often outsiders and genre fans, it's a trope that maybe hits too close to home. For me, it does.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up playing D&D and watching weird Herschel Gordon Lewis movies, and I was in chess clubs. So, you know, not necessarily the most popular person in the world, but yeah, so I can understand.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for a lot of us, there's, I'm grateful that I had parents that were supportive and let me, you know, told the people at the local video store, oh, he can rent whatever he wants when I was 11.
Same experience, actually. Yeah.
I think that's common, but I think some parents aren't like that at all. And I think those are the kids who end up not feeling like they have an outlet and a way to express themselves, and that can become, you know, that can get ugly and it can become pent up.
You're trying to show in the movie that because it's a despicable act, obviously, and no one's going to defend it, but that there is something behind it. There is a reason why people do things.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would hate to pretend that I know the reasons, but I do think that there's definitely a disenfranchisement in certain kids that makes them feel removed. And you know, I don't know that it's the school's fault. I don't know that it's the parents' fault. I just know it's something that we need to look at and think about. It feels very removed at the moment because of COVID, right? And the idea of kids being in school feels kind of like something of the past. But it doesn't change the positions of a world that allowed that to happen and continued to have drills for students, but not look at the root causes of those actions or of guns.
So the writer, Zach Chasler, you work with him a lot. So like, how did you guys get together?
Initially, I had a writing partner that I worked with for years that was a college friend. And he wrote my first movie, The Attic Expeditions. And we had like five projects that we've been working on for years and years. And the relationship soured, and he kind of took all the scripts and stepped away. And I was like, okay, now I have to find somebody who can write stuff that speaks to me. And I reached out to friends, and I had a friend that I saw at lots of parties who was from New York and said, you should talk to this guy, Zach. He wants to write horror movies. And pretty much as soon as we started talking, we hit it off like gangbusters. He secretly saved my ass on All Souls Day, which really had not much of a script. And it was like 2 weeks before production, and the producer wouldn't hire Zach. So I think I paid Zach and had to say it was me. And he just gave me notes. And then similarly, Zach didn't do a great job of kowtowing to these producers and saying, oh, I'm dying to work with you and you guys are geniuses. And so when my next movie was The Thirst, and the script wasn't what I wanted it to be. And they were like, well, you fix it. You fixed All Souls Day. And I was like, please hire Zach. And so Zach wrote The Thirst. And then he didn't get credit on that, but I've since tried to fix that in the world of the internet. And at the same time, we were trying to acquire the remake rights to all those Lewis titles. Got Wizard of Gore. He wrote Wizard of Gore. And he also wrote my segment in Theater Bazaar, the anthology film with Udo Kier.
Oh yeah, I've not seen that movie. I know for a long time that was one that I was wanting to see because like there was all kinds of issues about it being released, and like so many people are involved. But it is out. Like you can see it.
It is, and it's being re-released this fall. Also. With Severin and a loving huge
Severin puts package, out a lot of cool stuff.
A bunch of cool stuff and new commentaries. And Udo is really amazing in the movie. And we pulled off for, you know, very little money, something pretty extraordinary with him. I'm really proud of that.
Udo has the coolest eyes I've ever seen. I was around him for a little while, and they're like, they're kind of like intimidating, but also like very beautiful eyes. I don't know. I guess I have a main crush on Udo, but he's always a really cool guy, and there's just something about him.
He's a pleasure. I mean, like all like Crispin, like Jeffrey Combs, like a lot of actors who fly between very low budget films where they are working with first time or potentially first or second time filmmakers, and then do bigger films and are working with Peter Jackson or, you know, whoever, great filmmakers with gravitas. Udo comes with a lot of ideas and a lot of creative energy and wants to participate. And once he's in, he's definitely not just, you know, taking a paycheck and showing up. I went out to dinner with him a lot. I spent a lot of time with him, and we merged creatively to create the character that he plays.
Sure. Yeah. And he can drink a lot of vodka, and I'm not, you know, telling tales, I'm sure.
He's a lot of fun. I mean, he is a dynamo. He really is. He performed my wedding. We were lucky enough to have him say yes to performing the wedding. So my children will always know that Andy Warhol's Frankenstein is also, and Dracula, is also the person that married Mommy and Daddy.
That's awesome. That's pretty wild. Yeah. Okay. Tristan, do you have another question? Sorry.
So you are an editor, but you did not edit this film. Is it difficult for you to hand that over?
It was. A very dear friend who edited the film and I think did an incredible job, Max Gilman, had been my assistant editor at our day job initially for many years. And then on The Wizard of Gore, like with all my movies, at some point the people who fund them are like, well, we're not going to spend any more money. This is we're going to stop here. And so in post-production on The Wizard of Gore, there were a lot of effects that I wanted to do. And at the time, there was not a lot of what you did on your computer didn't necessarily become what is released. There was still this old notion that you go to a finishing place. And so we did a lot of color correction and a lot of building mats to create interesting transitions. And Max really worked with me to suss out and work through the tech side. And so after that, I was like, I think that you should take on the dead ones because I'm going to want to do a ton of that. And we did. I'm lucky because it did take 11 years in post. And, you know, every 6 months I'd call him and say, hey, I got 5 more green screen shots. We need to cut them in. And I have an idea for this scene. And when you don't have money, you find ways to continue to poke away at it. And we did. And I had a very specific vision for what I wanted the movie to be. And I think it was hard for him because he wanted to go down the line as an editor and start with a really fat cut that was 2 hours and 40 minutes and whittle it. And I needed to see the movie with sound effects and music and color corrected from the beginning so I could shape it. And that's exhausting for an editor. And he stuck with it, and I'm very grateful.
Do you normally edit your own things? I don't know if that's hard to do, to edit your own material.
You're not supposed to. I wouldn't advise many editors to do it, but I was doing so much editing of independent feature films that at some point it made more sense to me to take the reins because I could get there faster. It was harder to sit behind somebody, even if they were a great editor, and be like, okay, but that's great. Now let's, rather than cutting it down by 10% and then in a week doing another 10%, let's just cut it down by 50% right now and save the next 5 weeks. I can see it. And it's not really always the process. But I think the availability of nonlinear and the way that it's really become the standard, more and more editors are not of that sort of older generation that cut on film and wanted to take out a little bit at a time until you found your movie.
Mm-hmm. From my experience doing the show, usually directors who are editors by trade have an easier time editing their own material because I think they look at more like this is what I have to do for the movie as opposed to I'm looking at it as stuff I shot and I don't want to cut out my own art.
You have to be mercenary. Editing is about taking out anything you even question a little bit. It's always hard to say goodbye to moments and scenes and monologues and bits that you love, but most often those are the parts that have to go first.
So did you film it at an actual school, like an abandoned school? That's what it looked like.
I shot in Baltimore, where I'm from, wanted to do that sort of as a reaction to the way my frustration on The Wizard of Gore and you know, there was a time towards the end of post on that where the financiers wanted to cut out all the gore and felt like, this is a movie about people and it's about a reporter. And it was like, no, my fans are people want to see, no. And so, and there was a lot of butting heads surrounding Crispin's ideas and the financiers hand-wringing about that. So I wanted to go make a very small movie away from LA, not because I didn't have great experiences shooting in LA, because the crews are incredible there. They make movies all the time. Everybody who, you know, you're going to get somebody to do you a favor and key grip on your movie for a week in Los Angeles, you couldn't ask for a better key grip, no matter what. But I did not want to hire a cast for high schoolers who were jaded or who were, you know, doing Disney Channel next week and had just booked a yogurt commercial. And I wanted people who were actors but were coming to it from a different place. And I also didn't want to shoot in a high school we've seen a million times. There's just a limited number of high school locations on the West Coast in Southern California that you haven't seen before. And I wanted that brick East Coast school vibe. And so, yeah, we shot in Baltimore. The casting director is Pat Moran, who was John Waters' partner in all his early films and went on to be this amazing Emmy Award-winning casting director who did The Wire. And so she's great at finding people who are real people and also actors, right? So that was all appealing about going back to Baltimore and finding a way to, you know, go back to my hometown and make a film.
So over those 11 years, and you mentioned green screen, did you have to bring back any of those actors? And I assume that could be hard with someone who's, you know, playing high school, you know, over those 11 years, and it might not look like a high schooler.
So, yeah, no, we left Baltimore with 70% of the movie shot and everything covered for the principal cast. All the stuff with the horsemen sneaking around the school outside, we shot. I have a friend, you know, who was finishing. He had been in one of my movies. He played a kid, and he was now like an aspiring filmmaker. And he got us onto his school property, and we shoot at night with fake guns. And the assistant editor, and the editor, and the producer, and I were all wearing the gas masks. So we were lucky in that way that we could cover it like that. There's shots of the little girl of Grace that are my daughter. When I shot the movie, I hadn't met my wife, and since my daughter's grown up, but she plays Grace in certain shots. There was another little girl who does the makeup stuff. We had like 3 days of pickup shoots for the hellscape backdrop and some of the paper. We brought one of the paper mache monsters back out to California with us. So there was stuff we were able to shoot around. The actress who plays Mouse for all the over-the-shoulder shots of Mouse reaching in to save the girl and some of the duck shots, she met her now husband, who was the second unit cinematographer back in Los Angeles, on the pickup shoots of the dead one. So, yeah, we had to bring people back for ADR for just some dialogue pickups, but otherwise we're very lucky because of those gas masks.
I noticed some of the names were like old mythos and gods. I assume that was intentional.
Yeah, no, Zach really loaded the movie with I think a lot of layers of story to unwrap. And yeah, there's a lot of mentions of Egyptian death stories and layers of hell. And it's all kind of, you know, Greek and Roman and Egyptian and all wrapped up in there.
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, it's also a ghost story. And I think it's kind of a really a traditional ghost story in that where it's like where something bad happens and like kind of the memories of, you know, violence or horrific acts are still, you know, with in the walls and in the atmosphere.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so too. I think that it's one of the points that people miss is that, I mean, we'll see what happens. The movie comes out this week officially, but I think it's easy to miss that. It's not really like a first person shooter horror movie where you're just watching unabated violence for just to do it, but that it's a ghost story revisiting the terrible acts of the past.
How about the looks of the masks themselves? Was that something you were hands on with?
I have the privilege and also deep sadness to tell you that Elvis Jones, who was one of the partners of Autonomous Effects, Jason Collins and Elvis Jones, did all my movies after the Attic Expeditions. I started working with them on All Souls Day. Then they started their own shop on The Thirst, and they did Wizard of Gore. And Elvis designed those masks, came to Baltimore, did all the makeup effects, had a great team, but he has died very young while we were struggling to finish the movie. So the film is dedicated to him, and I think is an amazing homage to his genius and his artistry.
Well, that's a shame, though. I'm sorry he passed away.
He was a good friend and really a brilliant makeup effects and special effects person, and just had a solution for everything. Was so creative and a great guy to have on set. Just there's a piece on the Blu-ray and DVD about you know, we didn't get an interview with him, but he's on the set and his there's an intern who was my friend's sister-in-law in New York, who always made, you know, amazing Halloween costumes and makeups and wanted to work on a movie. And so we interviewed her on the set. So she kind of talks about working with Elvis and the experience of showing up on her first movie and getting to fling blood and learn as much as she did from Elvis.
Oh, well, that's very cool. Look forward to that. Yeah. Tristan, do you have another question?
So you do so much. I mean, you're an editor, director, producer, actor, writer. Like you do every job there is to do on filmmaking. And I'm assuming directing is your primary passion. But I'm wondering, do you love all of those positions, or are you doing them out of necessity because of indie filmmaking to facilitate directing?
Yeah, so I had to find, I worked in every position coming up in movies. I PA'd a ton. I was, you know, I was terrible at sound. I was terrible as an electrician at a grip. I figured out pretty quickly that editing was something I could bluff my way into. And then you were alone in a room and you could, you know, keep messing up until you could succeed enough to show somebody what you were doing. And I grew up with Super 8 film and then VHS, you know, old video cameras where you had to use two decks to edit. And so I always understood editing and loved editing. And so that appealed to me. But I grew up as an actor and I always loved working with actors and think that that's such a missed key for independent film and for genre film. You know, often I see films where so much emphasis has been put on the makeup effects and the blood and even the location, but the treating actors with respect and understanding their process is really, that's something I'm deeply passionate about and have always been excited to bring to my weird little psychedelic horror movies. And so, yeah, that is the thing I'm most passionate about. I think you're right. Out of necessity, indie films have you wearing a lot of hats. I have to be good at marketing and have thoughts about that. I spend a lot of time not doing interviews like this, which I love doing, but you know, people send questions and then you're writing essays. So you have to call on that part of yourself. You know, at this stage of the filmmaking, there's a lot of that sort of business of film stuff, but, yeah, if I had my druthers, I'd be on the set every day working with actors and having that creative interchange.
With the experience of the Dead Ones coming out now, does it make you miss making movies?
I love making movies, and I'm so grateful that I had an opportunity. And you know, I worked really hard for it. I don't come from money. I wasn't like, you know, I don't have a family that was like, here, come on in and join the family business. I really fought for that career, but I'm grateful. It's a privilege and an honor to ever get to make anything creatively. And I really regard that. I am 11 years older than when I wrapped The Dead Ones. And I'm very proud of the film. I think it's the first film I've ever made that when I watch it, it's the film I really wanted it to be in every way. I don't feel like it compromised anything. And that's really satisfying. And if somebody called me tomorrow and said, we'd like to hire you to direct a movie, I would most likely say yes. But I don't know, you know, I set out to make this movie with a very specific idea in mind. I made reference to this when we were talking about Baltimore. I wanted to make something where it wasn't, where it would like honored my style of doing, like I said, psychedelic horror movies that are kind of mindfuck horror films. But I didn't want to be oblique about what I was trying to say. I really wanted to be direct. You know, like The Wizard of Gore, I felt like it was really important at the time, pre, you know, the gore porno, whatever that whole movement was, yeah. To be like, why are horror films so often about misogyny? And is it our responsibility to like own some part of that as an audience? And that just, I feel like it never was addressed. It got lost. And the movie was liked or hated or loved or, you know, annoyed people. But no one really, there wasn't a lot of discussion about that. The Dead Ones was really my attempt to close the book on making a movie that did that successfully. I still consider myself a filmmaker, but I am employing my skills in different ways. I make films in my town promoting farmers and their farm stands and for social media and to kind of, you know, I made marketing pieces for huge studio movies for years. And so I like bringing those skills to bear for something that deserves it and using my powers for goodness.
I think that's great. I like that. Yeah. I'm not far from you. I'm in Massachusetts. So
I know we should post COVID make a haunted house.
I'm totally into that. I've been to, I don't know. Have you been to any since you've been to New England? I was at Haunted Overload in New Hampshire.
Spooky World. In college, I went to Spooky World, and last year I went again, and I still think it's spectacular. Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things about living in New England is that you have no shortage of haunted houses to choose from come Halloween. Maybe not this year, but
yeah,
again, soon.
Yeah. You've been to Salem since you've been there?
Not since I've been back, but I love Salem. I have friends who just set up their wacky antique store in Salem and shifted from Los Angeles during the pandemic. So Salem is definitely a hot spot in the non-COVID way.
Yeah. Salem's really weird because there's really cool shops like that and like old stuff. And then there's really like very touristy kind of, I don't see lame, but kind of silly, like, you know, very, you know, witchy stuff. So it's really, there's such a contrast that, and both of them are kind of cool in their own way, honestly, but I tend to like the older, you know, more real stuff. I went on a walking tour there in Halloween and they talked about the actual, you know, people that were killed and everything. That was a great experience, but I would suggest not maybe once, but it's really, for me, it's not the best to go during Halloween because it's just loaded with people that you not necessarily want to be around, you know, kind of college people that are just going there to be cool. And it's not the greatest.
Yeah. Bridge and tunnel crowd then.
Right. Right. Yeah. So I wonder about shooting action. There's a little more action in this movie, I think, than typically in your films. Have you ever done a lot of that? You know.
What's up? This is James D. Lamont from It Came From the 5-8 Productions, inviting you to listen to Culture Shock every second Monday right here on withoutyourhead.com.
In All Souls Day, Dia de los Muertos, there was imposed action sequences where the movie was handed over to stunt people who were directing second unit, and there was a lot of flipping and running over cars, and it's not really my thing. That sort of suddenly the movie stops and there's a bunch of flipping upside down, and I don't love that stuff. I don't love the zombie kicks in the face and flips around the head. It's not my thing. But in this movie, the action, I think, is driven by in a different way. I really try to avoid having guns in my movies until this film too. But I think there's a reason that you're going to tell this story with guns. I tried mostly to not have horror and guns mixed, because I think what's horrific is not always, you know, there are other ways to do that. But I don't have a ton of experience except for when I would get hired to do a movie and they would insist on certain stuff being very action oriented, and that wasn't always me who was doing that.
Yeah. How about maggots? Worked with maggots before?
I have. Well, Jeffrey Combs eats maggots. So I did have experience with maggots. It's nobody's favorite thing, honestly. Everyone, it really shuts a set down. For good reason, it gives us all the creeps. And so actors and crew members alike, just you can feel everybody tense on a set with maggots. My wife actually doubled Emily's arm for the maggot when we were dating. And that's how I was like, you really do love me. You're going to let me put maggots on your arm.
That's a very romantic story, Jeffrey.
You can imagine I met her 3 months after we shut down. And so for the last 11 years, as we started a family, and she's put up with an incredible amount of, I'm still not done, but I'm going to keep working on it. And I'm so grateful for that.
Yeah, I like that you said it's no one's favorite thing, because I would be worried if someone did say, yes, my favorite, I get to work with maggots.
Chickens, it might be chickens' favorite thing I've learned since I've started homesteading. Chickens adore maggots, but they might be the only ones.
Interesting. Was there any festival run at all? Did it get in, like, virtual festivals or any ones that ran before the pandemic? Yes.
We did premiere at Brussels April of 2019. And that was an amazing festival to premiere. We premiered in Brussels. And so that festival, I really didn't know, the audience tends to be very vocal. They're loud. They're screaming at the screen. They have, like, phrases. When a full moon, they see a shot of a full moon, they howl. They stuff in you know, multiple languages that they are laughing at, and you don't know what it is. And I'd seen a couple movies, obviously, because I was there, and it was like, oh, fuck. Can I curse?
Oh, yeah.
Is it bad?
Yeah, it's fine.
I was like, oh, man, this is not going to go well. And the executive producer was with me, and he's European, and I just was like, how are we going to sit through the dead ones with this audience? This is going to be painful. Hear them, like, cheering on, you know, the subject matter.
Yeah.
Oh. And the movie started, and they tried. Like, we got about 4 or 5 minutes in with the shouting, and I was, like, gripping my seat, and my heart's pounding. And then they just were silent. Silent. And, like, you could hear the gasps. And then at the end, people stood up and applauded. And it was packed, and I was like, oh, it worked. I was thrilled. And then we played another Hole in the Head in San Francisco, which is a festival I had done with All Souls Day. And then the pandemic really took hold. So, we did one festival in Europe and one festival in the U.S., and now the movie's coming out.
Well, it's good that you got to do a couple anyway. But
like, yeah, it was... Honestly, you with a film like this getting reviewed at festivals and getting smart writers and reviewers to see your film and to contextualize it makes such a big difference for the distributors, for you know, the platforms. They're able to see the words of people who can help them to figure out how to market it. And so not having that felt like it was going to really be a problem, but I'm grateful that so far it hasn't been. We got reviewed by Film School Rejects from Another Hole in the Head. I think that made a big difference because they placed it as their number one for 2019, and that kind of put us in a position that I think we otherwise wouldn't have been.
I don't know if it's something you'd have the answer to, but how do you think virtual festivals will affect that whole process of a movie getting reviewed and getting the word out and someone picking it up?
What do you guys think? Are you guys going to virtual festivals? Are you attending stuff like that?
Yeah. I mean, we did some for Fantasia Fest, and honestly, almost at this time, it's almost too many to keep up with because there's so many that are going on.
I I watch a lot of movies. I love movies. I watch a lot of movies at home. Mm-hmm. But the experience of watching a movie in a theater with an audience, especially like Fantasia in a beautiful theater where a film may never, ever get to see that experience again, it's heartbreaking. Look, everything about COVID is heartbreaking. There's not really much to be said that isn't like, this sucks. But another thing that sucks is that for audiences, for genre fans, and for filmmakers, this is a really complicated and tough time. And unfortunately, as you know, often happens in these times, the systems that were in place to withstand this, right? The stuff that Netflix finances and Amazon and Apple, those are going to be fine. They'll find a release, and they make enough of them that some of them are going to be successful and some of them won't. But I feel for my fellow filmmakers and fans, because it's going to be harder right now for the cream to rise to the top, but I think it always will.
Yeah. Like you said, I mean, if you think, like, as I was saying, the thing I miss the most are going to festivals and the movie theater. But at the same time, like, that compared to being healthy is, like, I'd much rather stay healthy than, you know, be going to the movies. But it is something that I do miss, you know, as a movie fan.
I will make my message clear, too. I really have no interest in dying so that I can...
Not to laugh at that, but yeah.
Not really. I'm perfectly happy watching movies at home and living.
Right. No, I totally agree. But like we said, though, I mean, we watch stuff all the time on the computer or on your TV. But for me, if you can watch really anything on the big screen with other people, especially, I think horror and comedy are the best to watch with a group of people. And I'm more of a horror guy than a comedy guy. So that's the best experience, I think. Like, a drama is cool, but you don't have the same, like, experience, I think, because you're not...
Yeah.
You know, there's no really interaction. You're not going to sit there and, I don't know what you do, cry together at the screen. I don't know. It's a weird experience.
Depends on the movie.
All right.
Yeah. If you've ever seen The Elephant Man with an audience, that's a movie that's like a super weeper, but you want to see it with an audience because there's a, you know, just as an example of an emotional movie that you might want to see with an audience. It's super emotional on your own, but in a theater, that movie is unbelievable. Very powerful. So all movies, everything, we should all be together in spaces because human beings are meant to interact. We can't right now.
My go-to joke was always, you know, when I talk about horror festivals, like, they don't make rom-com festivals, you know. But then I got an email earlier, it was probably real at the beginning of this year, that to promote the rom-com fest. And I was like, I can't use this joke anymore. And I was like, man, I don't know about going to the rom-com fest. Nothing against rom-coms, if that's your thing. But
it's not your thing, man. There's somebody's thing. Right. So can I ask you guys, did you guys get a screener of the movie?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Yeah, we were talking about it. How else did you think we saw it?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, all right. Well, so what did you think of the movie? Were you okay with it? Did it enrage you? Or you... Did you hate it?
Well, it's definitely a touchy subject to make a movie about, obviously. I thought it was done well. And to me, it was, as you said, it was more about showing why someone why someone becomes a school shooter. And I also like the elements of I brought up about it being like a haunted place because of all of the horrific things that happened there. And I find that interesting because I've been to, not places with a school shooting, but I've been to, you know, places that are considered haunted or there's like bad things that happen, old prison, whatever. And you do have a feeling like of, even if you don't know why, but it just feels uncomfortable, like that there is something there that's sticking there. It's a bad atmosphere. And so I found that interesting about the movie.
Yeah.
Tristan, I was wondering, you mentioned,
No, you go on, sorry.
You mentioned you have children, and I don't know how old they are, but I'm wondering if you've screened the film for them or talked to them about it.
Well, my oldest is 8, is turning 8, so no, I don't show them horror movies. We watch, you know, 40s musicals and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and appropriate films for their age. But they know that I make horror movies. They know the subject matter generally of the Dead Ones. But we don't spend a lot of time focused on it. But, you know, I have strong political views, as I think most filmmakers or people who feel like they have stories to tell do, or I would like to think they do. And they're very aware of those feelings and views. And, you know, like, you know, we have a farm. I have a gun. I have a gun because we have raised pigs. And when you kill a pig, it's the most humane way to kill a pig. But I also have very, very strong feelings about guns and about the NRA and about kids having access to guns. And so this really isn't answering your question at all. But I'm very clear with them that it's not the subject matter of the Dead Ones is of utmost importance. And as they get older, they'll certainly be more focus on that, you know, especially because we live someplace rural where, you know, that young people's access to guns is, you know, I don't want them playing at other people's houses where their parents have firearms laying around. I think that's horrifying.
Yeah.
Did that answer your question? Kinda, not really.
Yes, I'm also anti-children and guns, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did answer my question. I was just, yeah, thank you for talking on that.
Yeah, of course.
So, when is the official release for the movie?
September 29th on VOD and Amazon. And Apple. I actually think a friend wrote me today and said he thinks it's available on Apple as of today, so they may have released it a little early. So it's also playing in at the Senator and Charles Theater. I don't know when this airs, but for the week leading up to its release, it's available through their Kino Lorber platform through the Charles Theater in Baltimore and the Senator Theater in Baltimore. So
are you? I know you're a farmer now, but are you working on anything?
My dream is to have a barn theater where I can have families see entertainment that is right in front of their very eyes. I love movies, mm-hmm. but in working on a lot of studio fare and comic book movies and superhero movies and doing the marketing for those movies, for me personally, and this isn't necessarily everybody's experience, I grew up in the era of Star Wars and, you know, buying a magazine at the bookstore with pictures of, you know, a guy standing next to the Death Star that they were about to blow up. And it was so magical that everything existed in the physical world. And, you know, I read reviews of other people's movies and of mine when you fall back on using zeros and ones to accomplish things. It makes people, horror fans in particular, get really mad about that. And I understand, but we live in a world where solutions are often digital. And I think we have lost some magic. And I really feel as though reminding people that there is real magic in the world and bringing that back is my next really big goal. If I have to fight for something for 11 years or more, I'm going to fight for that.
Very good. I like that. Well, it was very cool to catch up with you.
Great to see you. Great to meet you. And thank you guys for having me on.
Yeah. We'll do it again sometime.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Did this go okay?
Yeah, very good. No, it's excellent. Yeah.
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 Okay.
Yeah, I thought it did.
I think.
Yeah.
All right. I hope you enjoyed yourself.
Always. It's yeah. I know that you love, I mean, we've known each other for years, and I know you love movies. And to me, I love movies. So whenever you connect with people who have that in them, that's a great thing.
I agree. Yeah.
So, I also like movies.
Yeah, I was going to add that. I was like, you know, I met Trista on a set of on a movie, and we have similar tastes and stuff, and it's always fun on the show, so it was cool to have her as the new co-host here, the new friendly creep.
I'm glad that you're on the show, Tristan. I'm glad you love me. I knew if you were on the show that you also love
movies. That'd be weird. You. We're going to get the take from someone who hates movies. All right. Very good. Well, it's good to see you.
Great to see you. Great to meet you, Trista. Thank you, guys.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, 11 years. I'm glad it's out there and people can see it.
Long road.
All right. Nice.
All right, take it easy, guys. Bye.
Hi. Suze Lanier Bramlett here, the original Brenda from Wes Craven's The Original Hills Have Eyes. Yeah, but right now I want to talk about voting. This is a picture of my dad. Now, he was neither a loser or a sucker, as Trump has referred to our servicemen and women who sacrifice their lives daily to defend democracy. Like John McCain, my dad was caught, captured, and tortured in World War II, fighting a vicious dictator who killed millions of people. Now, I don't know about you, but I've had it with this current administration. I would love to have a president who represents decency. Someone who doesn't lie, someone who's not afraid to show his tax return, someone who believes in science, not just padding their own pocketbook, and someone who wants to unite the people, not divide them. I hope you're registered to vote, and please consider supporting Joe Biden and Kamala Harris in this most important election of my lifetime and probably yours too. Biden-Harris 2020. Thank you.
From ancient terrors to the search for modern-day conspiracies, The Tomb of Nick Cage is the new sound in horror rock. Uncover the mystery of old world horror for the new world order on iTunes, Amazon, and more.
Ripley, we should have listened. Sit here on a lie. By Whalen Utani. Now we're gonna die.
The Tomb of Nick Cage.
Mostly, they're coming at night.
Find out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The Tomb of Nick Cage.
They're